My name is Martin Rizzo Martinez, and I am a historian. I currently work for California State Parks as the historian and tribal liaison for the Santa Cruz District. I think it's important to know that this area, Evergreen Cemetery, but the whole broader, really all of what we consider downtown Santa Cruz, was historically, before the mission got here, it was a village site for the Uipi people. The village went by the name of Aulintac, and Aulintac translates to mean the place of the red abalone. And this is the name of really that whole kind of area that we now consider kind of downtown Santa Cruz and right up around there. In 1791, Spanish came through and they founded Mission Santa Cruz, originally in downtown Santa Cruz, but then it moved up to the bluff there where it still is kind of the remnants of Holy Cross today, which you can kind of see from this area back behind here. And that, for about 40 years or so, became kind of the hub of Spanish capturing Native peoples, enslaving them here at the mission, and putting them to work. This area back here behind the mission was where the orchards were. And these were the orchards that were tended by Native people from throughout the area, right? Over time, Native people died off in huge numbers. Over 90% of those who came to Mission Santa Cruz died by the time it closed in that 40-year period. And so the people who were here were coming from kind of, you know, all over, stretching eastward all the way to the San Joaquin Valley as Spanish colonial violence kind of rippled outwards and brought people, captured villagers and brought them back here. Where I think this is really immensely significant, this area for indigenous communities, is that after the closing of Mission Santa Cruz in 1839, this area right here became the main reservation. And that lasted for up until almost 1890. But there is a good 40, 50 year period where this whole area behind the mission was where surviving members of the Native community that had come through Mission Santa Cruz lived, where they worked, where they built families and, you know, had community here. They had sweat lodges that lined this area that are talked about in some of the newspapers that pop up here. And there's all sorts of stories from the area. Most of the American newspapers referred to this whole area, they called the Potrero. And you can still see that with the Potrero Road that passes through here. But they refer to this area as the reservation because they knew that the Indians had lived here. And over time, that area kind of shrank as more and more people moved into the Santa Cruz area and started to build farms and homesteads all throughout this place here. I think one of the really interesting stories that comes out of this era is unfortunate. It's a tragic story that happened towards the end of the era of the Potrero as this kind of cultural hub for Native people. And it involved two young men who, 18, 19-year-old men, whose parents and grandparents had come through Mission Santa Cruz. They went by the names of Tahoe and Catch. And they were well known in the community. They worked at the tannery. They worked at multiple jobs kind of throughout this whole area here. And these two young men were, there was a series of arsons that took place in the 1880s, 1880 to 1884. In the Potrero area, a couple of them took place in kind of what would later be downtown Santa Cruz. And they were on kind of like these farms that were popping up owned by Americans coming in to the area. And you have to imagine at this time, you know, these young men were kind of growing up and seeing a, you know, a thriving community of survivors, you know, but like making do and making things work here. And very quickly, those lands were being bought up, were being taken over by farmers coming in, and they were losing all of their lands. In fact, the grandfather of one of these kids was Ricardo Carrion, who had been the song leader at Mission Santa Cruz during the mission era and had owned a house right next to the mission. And he ended up losing his house in the 1860s. It was due to a court case from a local judge who took it from him. So they had seen kind of this land loss. They had seen the dispossession. They'd seen the displacement of their families and communities, and had undergone immense hardships. One of the young men had lost most of his family members to a diphtheria epidemic that had passed through just a few years before. And so these arsons were taking place throughout the Potrero, and eventually these two young men were caught and arrested for burning these down. Another interesting element of the story is that that came out of these oral histories many years later is that apparently these two young men were had been interested in becoming working with the fire department. There's a very new fire department in town, but that wasn't really an option for them, right, for young Indian men at the time to go into this. And so when they were arrested and interviewed about this, they did say things like that they wanted to see the firemen work. They wanted to kind of light these fires and see them come out and put it out, and things like this. Now, I should note nobody was injured in these fires, but some barns were burned down and some fields. But these two young men were arrested and very quickly sent to San Quentin. And one of them died at San Quentin within a year. Second was sent to the insane asylum in Sacramento, where he died a year later. So they both passed away very young. And that era was kind of, this is 1884 when this happened, December. But that's right around kind of the ending of when this was a native space, you know, up until about there. So it's about a 40-45 year period where this was mostly, you know, a place where native peoples from the area had lived and made community. And one note on these on this story too that I think is really interesting. In the newspaper accounts and stories about these two young men, they talk about how people really liked these men. They were well loved by the community. They also said things like they knew where to find all the eggs in the area, right? And when you think about that, you know, why is it that they knew where the eggs were? Well, they were. You have to understand a little something about colonialism and the relationship that people have to the land. Now, these are people who have a long history of relationship to these lands. At the same time, they're surrounded by people who are moving in from back east or from Europe or from other places, right? And part of the aspect of colonialism is that people come with what they understand and they know, right? They bring with them the histories that they've come from and they project that outward, right? And so that's why you see these Victorian buildings coming up here, as they're people are trying to replicate the East Coast here in Santa Cruz. Well, for Native people, they have a very different relationship when they have a history of the land that goes back thousands of years. And so that includes a relationship with the environment, with animals of this area. And so it's easy to see where Native people would have had a different relationship with the birds. And we know that birds are, in many ways, if you understand the language that they are using, right, they tell us about the environment, right? They are like a satellite system that helps us learn about what is happening all around us. And so I think that the fact that they knew where the eggs were leads to a lot more of understanding. They actually had a deeper engagement with this environment, right? They knew about the birds, right? They probably understood what the birds were telling them in this way, right? They connected with this environment on a deeper level than most of the settlers who are coming into the area who didn't have that knowledge. They didn't understand. And so for their point of view in these newspapers, they're writing that these young boys have, you know, access to these, you know, somehow they were able to find these eggs and they were able to provide these. They knew where to find like the berries that were in the area. But what it really speaks to is that they were part of a community that had a much deeper understanding and way of listening and connecting to the environment. So the name for hummingbird, indigenous name was Umunya, which is actually really close to hummingbird. It's interesting. And there's a mountain in the Santa Cruz Mountains that initially was the highest peak in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And it's called still today Mount Umunum, which is taken from the hummingbird. Mount Umunum is a really important place for local Native people. It's kind of the origin. It's the mountain where people came from. And interestingly enough, if you're at the Mission Santa Cruz, kind of the adobe there, there's a deck that kind of sits over the bluff, and you can look up and you can actually see Mount Umunum from the mission site. which is interesting because it makes you think that people at the mission were able to kind of see the place of their creation, right, off in the distance there. But the significance of hummingbird for local indigenous peoples is that hummingbird, in a very famous story, brought fire to the people. And the story goes that Eagle had asked hummingbird to go get fire from the badger people. And the badger people were underground, and they had taken fire to themselves, and they had a fire going there. And I think hummingbird was sent down by Keknu, which is the eagle, and Eagle sent hummingbird, and hummingbird wasn't able to get the fire, right? Badger people kind of shoot him off. And so hummingbird went back up, and Eagle sent him back down to do it. And this time, badger people had taken a blanket, a deer skin, and thrown it over the fire. And so when hummingbird came in, he saw the deer skin over the fire, and luckily he saw a hole in the deer skin, like an arrow hole, where the deer had been killed. And so hummingbird, with his long beak, went in, and he was able to kind of reach through that hole and grab an ember of fire, and then flew off with it. And he had it in his beak there, and it started to burn his throat, right, on the way back to give it to Eagle. But he was able to bring it back and brought it to Eagle, which brought it to man. And this is how hummingbird still has a red throat, right? And so this is the story explains how hummingbird sacrificed to get fire, and in turn burned his throat, which we still see today. So the oak tree and all of its varieties, there's quite a few throughout the Bay Area, but was an incredibly important tree and resource for Native peoples. And this is in large part due to the acorns. And as many people know, the acorn was a really important for throughout California source of food, source of carbohydrates. And there was a long process involved with the development, the storage of acorns. But it's also, you know, acorns would be gathered throughout the year, and they would be held in these kind of storage bins that are all made out of basketry. And it's worth noting that in a general sense, you know, the California basketry, California Indian basketry, is really among the most sophisticated and amazing, incredible basketry in the world. And this is largely due to the abundance of different grasses throughout California. And these grasses, what the Spanish didn't realize when they came here, they made assumptions that Native peoples were hunter-gatherers, right? We still use those terms today. And yes, they hunted and gathered, but they did many other things as well. But they also tended the environment, right? They tended the forest. So when the Spanish saw that they just had a natural abundance of what they needed, what they didn't realize that abundance had been created through thousands of years of land management, right? Certain plants had been raised in certain areas. There are places out in the forest and outside the forest that are, you know, rich in a particular plant. And that's because they tended them this way. So they knew where to get the plants that they needed. And so they would make, every year they would burn, right, to help kind of replenish the soils, and to, they would shift around where they would tend. So they had a very sophisticated way of doing this. But the acorn in particular was one of their main food sources that they could rely on, because they would store these, then they would pound down the acorns, they would then kind of make it into a powder, then they would they'd have airtight baskets that they would make, or I should say waterproof baskets that they would fill with water and hot stones that they could boil the acorn mush, right, into, to make like this mush, right, acorn mush that they would add other things into as well, and season. So, you know, acorn, I think, is one of the huge ones. And this, of course, comes from these oaks that are in the area. But I think, you know, most of these plants, I mean, there was medicines that were taken from, you know, different plants. And, you know, there was an awareness of these that still, you know, tribes today are many times relearning some of these, but learning to practice these. But, yeah, quite an abundance throughout the area, but that was, you know, well maintained. The Evergreen Cemetery was an early Santa Cruz cemetery, but it was, in many ways, it was the alternative to the cemetery right across the way over at the Mission. And the Mission Cemetery was the Catholic cemetery, and where most of the Native people who had come through the Mission were buried, next to the Santa Cruz Mission. And that has its own story. But in terms of the Evergreen, a lot of early pioneers, and especially those who didn't want to be buried in the Catholic ceremony, would end up there. And one of the stories that has come out of Tracy Bliss, her work and her book on the Evergreen, but she has a theory, and I think it's a good one, that there is a Native man buried in an unmarked grave at the Evergreen Cemetery. And we don't know, none of the records show where he's buried, but she found enough evidence to suggest that he is indeed buried there. And this is a man known as Lorenzo Acisara. And Lorenzo was a survivor of Mission Santa Cruz. He was born in 1820 at the Mission, and he lived until the early 1900s, probably 1902, 1903, when he passed away in his 80s. But he's incredibly important because a lot of reasons, but one of them is that in the 1870s and 1880s, he gave three different interviews to historians, to researchers who were trying to learn stories. And unfortunately, there are not very many firsthand accounts of life from an indigenous point of view from people who lived at the missions. In fact, there are very few. You can count them on one hand. And Lorenzo's is one of those. In fact, he has three different interviews, like I said. So his stories, his father was one of the people involved in the assassination of a brutal, sadistic padre, Padre Quintana at Mission Santa Cruz, which has become kind of a infamous story or famous story, in large part because Acisara gave the, you know, very firsthand account of what had happened from an indigenous point of view. So when you walk around there, you know, keep in mind that, you know, this really important figure, Lorenzo, is likely buried in this cemetery. So for Native people of the Bay Area and many in California, as with most people, the burying of the dead, the taking care of people after they passed is a really important ritual in society. And so for Native people of this area, one of the really interesting things is that people were aligned in a lot of different ways. They associated with their particular village. They identified with the larger tribe that they were in. They identified in many different ways. Some had certain connections to, you know, certain spiritual societies that would happen across tribes. But they also had affiliations with particular clans that were associated with animals. So the most common ones were people who were part of bear clan or part of deer clan, and things like this. And one of the things that would happen when, let's say, a member of Deer Clan would pass away, right, of this particular family, the taking care of the body, the arrangements for the funeral, kind of all that preparation would be done by members of one of the other clans. So Bear Clan would take care of Deer Clan, somebody who had died there. And this is a way of kind of building social cohesion, right? It was a way that allowed the grieving clan family members to grieve, right? To just be able to grieve. You know, oftentimes they would cut their hair, which is kind of a common thing throughout Indigenous Americas. You know, but they would do their own grieving practices. They would wail. A lot of stories talk about their, you know, the particular crying, right? There was a ways to getting out that emotion. And oftentimes people at the missions describe this wailing a lot. But when you think of how many people are passing away at the missions, it makes a lot of sense. People were almost perpetually grieving in those very, very difficult spaces. But these are some of the things that would happen. So when the mission came and the padres imposed Catholicism on Native peoples, one of the things that comes up multiple times is that they would impose upon them a Catholic mourning ceremony, right? Catholic rituals around last rites and these types of things. And you see examples of kind of resistance against that, or ways that Native peoples found ways to continue their own mourning and grieving practices in spite of this imposition as well. We also find when in the stories in the 1880s, when they were rebuilding the former mission into the Holy Cross building, the Victorian that's up there now, they removed thousands of bodies from the cemetery that had been there, and they brought them across town to the Holy Cross Cemetery that's by Arana Gulch there, over by Jeffries. And in the process of doing that, they wrote about this. What's interesting is they talked about how a lot of these grave sites, when they would go to remove them, they found like beads, they found shells that had been put in there, feathers. And I think this is one way we can recognize that even though the missionaries were imposing their own ways of mourning on them, Native people found a way to continue their own practices, right? Around the eyes, right? The padres would have prohibited them from doing those types of things, and yet they still found a way to do that, right? They still put in the prayers and the items to bury with the dead that they would have done traditionally. And so they found ways to kind of keep with their own traditions in spite of kind of this imposition. The other thing I can say about mourning in indigenous Santa Cruz is that the ocean was seen as the place where the spirits go. And this is true throughout California, coastal tribes. And so a lot of prayers were made around sending, you know, prayers to the dead at the coast, right, into the ocean, because that's where spirits would go. Another interesting story around this comes from the theory of Ed Ketchum, who's the tribal historian for the Almamutzin tribe. But Ed talked about how the condor was seen as the speaker to the dead. He would carry the prayers to the dead. And when the Portola expedition was the first Spanish overland expedition that came through in 1769, that was part of the kind of founding of Spanish society in what was called Alta California, right, throughout what we know as California. And when they came through the Watsonville area, some of the scouts had gone ahead, they'd seen a village, they'd been fed by villagers, and this would have been Tijuvta, right, the place of the elk, which is right there in Pajaro Valley. And the scouts came back to the larger group, which was struggling. They had scurvy, they were dying, and they continued their way up. And when they got to this village site, they found it empty. And the Spanish interpreted this as, oh, they were afraid of us coming, and so they left, which we now know is not really true. But one of the things they found there was they found a wooden pole, and on the top of the wooden pole was a very large bird. They called it a great eagle. We now know that probably was a condor, and the condor had been stuffed with grass, right? It was a dead condor that was up there and stuffed with grass. And this is why, so the Spanish referred to this as the Pajaro, right, which means bird in Spanish. And that's why we call Pajaro Valley is the name it is because of this giant condor that was put there. But the really interesting thing, when I was doing the research on this and trying to understand, well, what was going on for the villagers there? If they weren't leaving because of the Spanish, what was this? And this is where Ed's story really was incredible, right? And so what Ed shared with me, his theory, is that was a time when, that was during the condor ceremony. And so they had set up this effigy for the condor because of the ceremony. It had nothing to do with the Spanish, had to do with the timing. So Ed theorizes that the condor with its red head was associated with the planet of Mars. And sure enough, if you look at the ephemeris at that time, 1769 and fall, right at that same time, Mars was going conjunct to the sun, which made it disappear behind the sun for a couple months. And so that's when this village site, basically packed up. And sure enough, Ed pointed out that when Portola's expedition came back through, they worked their way up to San Francisco, with the help of the Quiroste, by the way, who fed them and helped them. And when they came back down through this area, they passed through what was probably Moss Landing, just south of Watsonville there along the coast. And when they ran into a group of villagers who were there, the scouts recognized that these were the same villagers that had been up at that empty site where the bird had been. And so Ed points out that Condor was the one who carried the message to the dead. And so for the Condor ceremony, which would happen every 10 to 12 years, they went down to the coast, to Moss Landing there, where they sent out their messages and their prayers to the dead, right, via Condor. So I think that gives us a little more insight, A, into how indigenous peoples were in their own world. They weren't reacting to the Spanish. They had their own very sophisticated society here, but also to the role of Condor in this and the role of mourning and sending prayers and all this. The people who lived in the Santa Cruz area, I'm talking about from around Arana Gulch up to maybe a little less in Davenport, Scotts Creek area, were called the Uipi, is what they called themselves. The Spanish spelled this, of course, Native people didn't have a written language, so the Spanish spelled it U-Y-P-I. And I always say when people ask, how do you pronounce these things? You think of it as you're reading it from a Spanish accent, right? Because these are written by Spanish speakers in their tongue. And so I pronounce it Uipi. It could be a little different. Every once in a while it's spelled maybe as a plural U-Y-P-I-N, as the Uipin. The chief of that tribe at the time when the mission was settled here was named Soquel, although it's written variously as Suger, Suquer, in multiple ways. But that eventually becomes, of course, Soquel, which is such a huge name in the Santa Cruz area, right, for the boulevard, the township. Those are all named after the chief of the Uipi. To the south of the Uipi was a tribe known as the Aptos, and of course that's where Aptos comes from. And to the north of them along the coast was a tribe called the Cotoni, which they spelled C-O-T-O-N-I. The Cotoni went from about Scotts Creek up to about Waddell, Waddell Creek, right up there. And to the north of them was what was the most powerful and largest tribe of the Bay Area, who were known as the Quiroste. The Quiroste lived in the Año Nuevo area, kind of at that big point up there, and through that what now is called Quiroste Valley, that valley there. So those are kind of the main tribes. The other question, I know people get confused on this, but we think of these tribes as being some of the 50 or so independent tribes of the Bay Area, which are now today called the Ohlone. The Ohlone is a native word, but it's relatively new in its usage. Really in the 70s is when it started to become used. Before that, the Spanish had labeled them as the Cosnoan, which just means coastal people, doesn't mean much. But they're grouped together because linguistically they have a lot of ties. There's about 8 different languages spoken throughout the Bay Area, but these are different dialects of a larger interconnected language, the Ohlonean language. The people of Santa Cruz spoke the Awaswas language, so often people will refer to them today as Awaswas people, and that's a way of kind of grouping together the people of the Santa Cruz coast and the mountains around here. There's very little left of the Awaswas language. There's only a few vocabulary lists that were recorded in the 1800s, but their neighbors were the Mutsin speaking peoples, and those were peoples from just over the hill, Morgan Hill, Gilroy area, all throughout there. And today, the Amamutsin hail mostly from those groups. They're working hard to reinstate the language and relearn it. They're a large group. In their language, the word Ama means the people. And so it's the people of Mutsin, which is the language, but it's also a place. There was a place called Mutsin, which is near San Juan Batista. And that tribe, their members are survivors from mostly San Juan Batista, but also have connection to Mission Santa Cruz. And so there really is a diversity of different tribes and peoples throughout the Bay Area. I mentioned, too, the the village that was where Santa Cruz now is, and that's Aulintoc. You know, I think that there's an opportunity to relearn these names, to bring these back. And as, you know, as one Amamutsin tribal member, a young grad student named Alexi Sagona, he was talking about the ways that the Ohlone names for villages often had to do with particular animals or plants or something in the environment. And it's a different way of thinking, right? It's a different way of being. We tend to, in our society, we name things after individuals, after people, right, that we're holding up and we're honoring. But their way of naming things was a little different. It had to do more with a relationship to the animals that were of that area. And Watsonville was a village called Tiyufta. And Tiyufta means the place of the tule elk. And all the counts talk about how there were abundance of tule elk in the Watsonville Pajaro Valley area there. So these names are not just symbolic, but they also speak to the types of animals that lived in that area, right, that they had relationships with at that time. And so maybe a shift to bringing back some of those indigenous names could also go hand in hand with a shift towards being aware of the environments that we're living in, right? Instead of a focus on kind of the human element of it, right, which is one part of many. I think that people today, luckily, are more interested in trying to understand and learn from the environment that we're in, right? I think, you know, when I think back as a historian, you know, you think back of what would things have been like or could things have been like had, you know, had the Spanish arrived here, instead of making assumptions and trying to impose their values on Native people, but actually asking questions and trying to learn about the environment, it would be a whole different thing. But then again, that, you know, they wouldn't be coming here probably for those reasons. So I think that what we can do today is, you know, we have this, you know, violent colonial history that we're living in the aftermath of. But Native people are still very much here today. So I think we can start by listening to and supporting Native people today, listening to the causes that are important. Like I mentioned, you know, there are fights going on throughout the Bay Area to protect places like Uristock, to protect the shell mounds, to protect what is still here, sacred sites that are still around. So I think those movements are really important. But on a more personal level, I think, I think that there is something very important about connecting with nature, getting out into nature, listening to birds, right? Learning the languages of birds, learning about, you know, what animals live in the area that you're in and being aware of them. So I think that people can develop a deeper awareness and appreciation for the environment that we live in, and hopefully hand in hand go work to try to protect the what we have in the environment, right? There's constantly new developments and things, and I think we have to be really careful because we make these massive changes that you can't go back, right? You can't bring back a sacred site once it's been turned into a parking lot or a gravel pit. So I think that's what we can do today, is to try to deepen our understanding, spend more time out in nature, and again, learning and listening to, seeking out, you know, who are the Native people where you live, and how can you work in solidarity with their goals and what they're working for today.